This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. Benjamin Bush, try it again. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. Benjamin Bush has seen a lot of the world. He grew up in New York, attended Vassar, and has traveled extensively as a writer, actor, and filmmaker. As a Marine, he served two tours in Iraq. Bush now lives in northern Michigan, and he has been hosting a series of workshops for veterans and their families at Western Michigan University this fall called Talking Service. Benjamin Bush, thank you very much for being here.
Hey, it's a pleasure to be in Kalamazoo.
You are the son of a novelist, Frederick Bush, who people may have read his stuff or at least have heard of him. But I've heard you say that you did not grow up thinking about being a writer. How did you get there?
I always thought that my strongest, I guess, skill set was always in the visual arts. I thought that I could express myself through imagery. And my father, of course, had always been obsessed with language instead. And, you know, the old maxim that one is not the other is not true. I came to writing very late. Actually, in my first tour in Iraq, you were allowed to send home letters for free, written on anything, a piece of cardboard box, whatever was lying around. There wasn't much paper. And so every once in a while, I would write home. And it was really the first time that I'd, by circumstance, been given only language to describe my situation. And we didn't have any reporters. There was nobody particularly interested in the Iranian border in 2003 as everyone rushed to Baghdad and left us there. So there was no sense at home of what any of us were really doing, and it required sentences. And I had to begin in my own, you know, my own mind to take these mostly images I was seeing and apply language to them in a way that someone could recreate far away. And so letters home were really my first serious language upon which I was dependent to really speak and see. And that's where I realized that transference was possible with words. I kind of didn't believe it the same way my father had, because I thought I could, well, if I show you, then we both have a common frame of reference. It looks like this. But I couldn't show you even in an image what it felt like, what it sounded like, what it smelled like. An image couldn't do that. And so I really gained my appreciation of what my father had done his whole life, not until I was 35, which sounds stunning that I could be so, set against its possibilities. And I think some people still feel that way. I'm talking about someone, I went to a great college, but I only took freshman English. The rest of my time was spent in studios with clay or steel or printmaking and drawing. So that's where I first realized it. My second tour in Ramadi, which was just a vicious tour, once a month, I wrote a letter home to friends and family. And that was serious prose. That's where I brought the full weight of language to bear many times, because I thought it would probably be the last they'd ever hear from me with those letters. I never knew if I'd make it to the next month. And I look at those letters now and I think, I think I got a lot of things right.
So going back before that, how does someone who, is the son of a novelist who goes to Vassar, studies the visual arts, decide at some point that he's going to be a Marine?
Well, a lot of people think that the two can't live together, that they're entirely different disciplines. And for me, the Marines and the artist were braided, just kind of interconnected and at a certain point almost interdependent. I wanted to be a knight when I was a kid. It sounds romantic and silly, and to a certain extent, that's exactly what it is, because there's no consequence in those childhood perceptions of what war is, what honor is, what duty is. But I had it in me, always, and even though my parents were Vietnam War protesters, there's no way they wanted me to head in that direction, and they certainly never encouraged it. But they also, they saw in me who I was, and they didn't stop me, which I think is the greatest gift a parent can give a child, is to let them be who they are. And so after 3 years at Vassar in between my junior and senior year, I went to Officer Candidate School, which is where they evaluate you for the Marine Corps, if you're going to be an officer after graduation. And it was absolutely miserable, and I loved it. There was something about its impossibility, the fact that they didn't want me to make it, that that pulled exactly the right strings with me. I was always kind of a stoic and drawn to a certain type of physical suffering to prove that I couldn't be destroyed, and the Marines seemed like exactly the right place to test that over and over again. And so after graduation, I went in as a young second lieutenant to be an infantry officer.
If you had never joined the Marines, had never served, had never seen combat, do you think you would have found that path ultimately to writing? Or did you have to go through that to really discover that within yourself?
I may have. I may have required extremity. I've always kind of worked from a particular kind of chaos. Even my visual work is just strewn about me. I pull reference and influences from my surroundings all the time, like everybody does, like writers do, you know, like artists have always done. Everyone's kind of a collage artist, whether they're using language or images, just because no one grows up in a black box. We've all been exposed to advertisements and anything else, which is part of the visual landscape and does, on some level in our minds, influence the way we see and the way we conceive of new work. But whether I would ever come to language, I'm not sure. I became a filmmaker, and those need a script. So on some level, I had to deal with conversational language. I had to deal with dialogue. And I don't know if that would have been my way into prose writing or not, if I would have stayed exactly in screenwriting. Like most screenwriters never write anything outside of screenwriting, in my experience in L.A. But that doesn't mean that I wouldn't have kept searching for different ways to express myself. I write a lot of poetry now, which I never would have thought that would have been something I would have been comfortable with. And I think it's the hardest thing that I do. I feel always vulnerable that I'm not getting it right. I know that I can write a good sentence now. I think I feel confident about how to build an articulate sentence. But with poetry, I'm always changing one word, which has a huge impact because there's such little language in a poem. You're trying to use the least possible. So have I used the least best? Is always the question I'm asking myself. Do I move this comma? Do I change this line? If I would have come to that, I don't know. But I got to that through prose because I realized there were some things I was writing in prose which needed to be by themselves, which needed to lift out of sentences and paragraphs. And even though I hadn't studied poetry, poetry was the right genre for it. And then I tried to sneak all these different things into films, and then I sneak things from films that failed back out. So I'm always trying to find the right place for these lines. And I have a huge stack of incomplete, both poems and pieces of essays and short stories and films. Whether they'll ever have a home, whether they'll ever be finished, I don't know. But at some point, I was driving somewhere and saw something and thought, huh, there's a scene, and started writing on it. So, you know, I really don't know. I think it's interesting when students go to a place like this university, coming from places where maybe language hadn't been valued or hadn't been used by them in a way which they realized its power. And suddenly they take a course here, and it opens up their mind to all the possibilities that language has. I mean, you'll have people go counterculture and say, you know, I don't like, you know, formal English. Well, you know, there's an awful lot of ways that English is utilized that they might not even realize is hugely important to them.
So when you're leading a workshop like those at Western Michigan University for veterans, do you have to draw out certain people sometimes to get them to try and express themselves? Are they, you know, perhaps they've had a bad experience overseas. Maybe they are still kind of getting used to being a civilian again. And do you have to work with them, I guess, gently, at least for some of them?
I work with all that gently. I work with my own work with absolute cruelty. I'm brutal to myself, but in workshop, that's not my position. What's true for every artist is it has to come out of the artist. I don't know that I can draw anything out of anyone, but if I can show them a pathway, even by example, which we teach, we use standing down in this course, From Warrior to Civilian. It's a book they get for free. And it just has excerpts, little short passages from everything from Greek plays where they talk about the veteran experience all the way up to, the desert wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. And, the hope is in these little gatherings that something that someone wrote echoes in their own experience. And even though it's not going to be the same, it never exactly is, it can show them that, first of all, that their experience is important. I can't even tell you how many veterans I've spoken to who don't think that anything they did was ever important, that they just did a small job somewhere, whether it was in Germany or whether it was in Oklahoma, and they did it for 3 or 4 years and they were good at it, and then they went home again and they think that that wasn't significant. And I can't, it's so wrong. When they begin to talk in these workshops or other people talk around them about things which were hilarious, just the funniest stories come out of military service, just a bunch of people sitting around, usually bored, when we see how bizarre we are as creatures. And then suddenly they remember, oh yeah, for 3 years, I was in that funny group, or I was in that misery, or I was in something which was, beyond my early dreams of what I'd ever do living in southern Michigan. I never thought I would be on Okinawa. I never thought I would be in the Horn of Africa. And no matter how isolated their job is, they were exposed to an entire new world. They traveled, they left home. They've done something extraordinary, even if in their own mind, they're looking around thinking that it wasn't. And I think that's where storytelling begins, because they've all told stories. Even the most reticent and quiet of them, I think it's usually just they see it in someone else and realize that they carry it too. And it's worth exploring.
Do you find that veterans have to be drawn out a little bit in terms of maybe their most horrific experiences, that those can still be tough to talk about even when you're meeting with them years or decades later?
Absolutely. I mean, we have World War II veterans, Korean and Vietnam veterans, and these are people who have had decades and decades to either try to cover this all up in their heads or to try to find a way to express it. And many of them are haunted to their deaths by the things that they can't say, the things that they couldn't find someone else saying for them. It's not my intention to make anyone write their histories, write their biographies, to be therapeutic, although all these things tend to happen. And whether it's for their own families or the archive that we keep of American experience in the Library of Congress, et cetera, I think the hardest part for a lot of veterans is their isolation from people who have a shared experience. And they just simply believe that no one could understand. And when they're in another group of people, even if they haven't had a shared experience of being in a particular war or fighting or anything, they all went to boot camp. They all began with a singular mission, which was to serve the nation and be part of an incredible machine. Whether you like that or not, that's what they did. And I think sometimes hearing other people just begin that discussion where they all realize they're part of a tribe, and it's an immense tribe, millions of people in it, men and women, but they're in the tribe. And that's when I think you begin to hear people speak to things which they've kept from everybody else. And it's not because they were a secret. It's just they just didn't think anyone would understand, would get it. And it's the old joke, about the veteran. How many veterans does it take to change a light bulb? you wouldn't understand. That's the answer. Right. There's no answer for that. And some people really feel that. They really feel that that there isn't language for what they've seen and done, that there isn't an audience to hear the story they really want to tell. I'm that audience. This group is that audience. And everyone gets something from it. Sometimes it's those stories that bring out the story of another who needed someone to start speaking.
How were you wounded in Iraq?
We were on our way to a headquarters on a what was considered a permissive route. There's a lot of interesting military words you begin to learn, which is great for a writer. We call things, you know, just the strangest stuff. Like your pen is not a pen, it's an ink stick. You know, I'm not wearing sneakers, I'm wearing Go-Fasters because they're faster than boots. I don't name these things, but I know the names of them.
As a writer, it's good to incorporate.
It's great stuff because sometimes, you know, people almost talk in a code and military talk. Only some of it really gets its way into the American dialogue, the vernacular. Like good to go is a military term. Mm. You know, you're good to go to the war. But we all say that now for everything. But they came out of the military. And so we were going past a corner, and it had been mined with a 155-millimeter artillery round, which had a small receiver transmitter attached to the blasting cap in the front, you know, the igniter. And all they had to do was make a phone call. It's basically the small bit of electricity that a cell phone emits when receiving a call is all the electrical current it needs to set off an artillery round if you wire it in. And it went off and just cut shreds through the side of our vehicle. And everyone in the vehicle was wounded. I was the first one out of the vehicle trying to find a way to secure our situation. I also wanted to find out who did it, which I could not. We were surrounded by Iraq and surrounded by traffic. And I was lucky. I had my back to the blast because I didn't trust the bridge we were passing near. So I was looking at that. And the blast came from behind me and, you know, pieces of hot metal just went into my arm. The rest of it stopped in my flak. So looking around the vehicle, which I had to do very briefly, trying to assess the situation, I was a senior man on the truck. This was a very administrative move. We were not prepared for what became of us that day. You know, there were people missing parts of them. And someone who was sitting right next to me had a small sliver of metal that went underneath his neck guard. And we didn't know what was wrong with him. He had just frozen. And I thought it was shock. So I was kind of getting us to treat him for that. But in fact, his body had involuntarily locked in the sitting position. And we took him out of the truck as if he was sitting in a chair because his body would not move. So he was still in a seated position as we carried him around. It was like magic, you know, like possession. And the body is an incredible organism. It doesn't want to die. And it knew that if it moved, that one tiny piece of metal in his neck could sever the artery. And he would have bled out in moments. We wouldn't be able to save him. And he survived. But that was, my wounding was kind of the least interesting part of it for me. I didn't even take stock of it until we got to the casualty center. And then I kind of realized that my arm wasn't just hurting. It was, you know, it was damaged.
And I bring it up because you have talked before about the idea that you at once feel invincible, and yet there's a sense of doom that surrounds you when you go off into combat. And I wonder if that becomes a little more real at that point. Does maybe the realization that your mortality is at stake become that much more obvious to you in that moment?
Absolutely. And I talk about that a little bit in my book, Dust to Dust. But my first tour, I kind of had to wear invulnerability as if it was truth. You know, it's fantasy. But I carried it that way to the point where I even believed my own myth. And I did it for my Marines. I was, you know, a company commander at the time. And they looked to me for a certain stability. Whether they liked me or not, that was my position, was to be invulnerable. And although I didn't run around like I couldn't be shot, I also began to not believe it at all. Like, really, not like a crazy person, but I just didn't believe myself to be in threat. And in my second tour, I was wounded that first 2 weeks. We were just doing a change of units, and that's why I was on my way over to the headquarters from Hurricane Point. That's what it was called, a Marine position in Ramadi, the city of Ramadi, up the road from Fallujah. And when that happened, I thought, okay, well, I'm definitely going to be killed this time. The city was just a disaster, and I was going to be very obvious in it because of my position. I would be someone they'd be looking for if anyone cared to check on who was in charge of things. And so they became the same kind of feeling. I guess I can't remember what I wrote, but it's, you know, that being immortal and being doomed created the same lacking of anxiety in me, because if you're immortal, you're not worried. And if you're dead already, you're not worried. And I felt that to the point where when I left Iraq, I didn't care. Like so many people you hear about pining for home. I didn't pine for home because I was dead. And when I got home, that was the hardest adjustment, was this strange gift of not being dead. And it took me a while to find any comfort in that.
And this is with a family at home.
Family at home. I had a little baby that I came home to on her very first birthday. I got home exactly on September 27th, which is coming right up, and she's going to be 12. So that was 12 years ago when I returned from Ramadi. And, you know, I was suddenly presented with being a husband and a father again after having been in that environment where there was only really a couple things at work, and the biggest one was death.
So since you were over there for two tours and saw it firsthand, you know, and I realized that you're stationed at different places and you don't see everything, but what would you say is the greatest misperception you hear from people when they talk about Iraq who never went over there, civilians?
Well, that's very complicated. You know, Iraq is three countries, first of all. You know, if we'd listened to Lawrence, it might have been three countries, a Shia, a Sunni, and a Kurdish state. I thought we were going to turn them into those three countries when we had all the power there was, but we did not. We restored it to, you know, its centralized government for the sake of convenience, really. And when you apply democracy to a place that suddenly realizes it has minorities, suddenly everyone who is a minority is not happy. And the Sunnis realized they had 20% forever. And I remember one guy, you know, really a wizened Iraqi in Ramadi, who was a judge. And I was trying to explain, you know, the benefits of democracy, you know, because that's what we were selling, you know, the freedom of choice. And he said, "I see the news, and in America, when the Democrat Party and the Republican Party only have 49%, they say they can't get anything done until there's another election." I said, "Well, I have to admit, because of partisan politics, you're correct. And that's something we need to overcome in my country." And he said, "Well, imagine if either party had 20% on their best day. Would you ever get anything, or would you have to fight?" So I couldn't argue with his logic. And that's when the civil war really began in earnest between the Shia and the Sunni. The Kurds didn't care either way. They kind of had free reign to the north. So my first tour, I had been on the Iranian border with the Shia. My last post was guarding Babylon, which sounds really kind of amazing as a phrase. Well, you know, what are you doing? I'm guarding Babylon. What are you doing? You know, but the truth was, this was the time of the Army of the Willing, a coalition of the willing. And the Polish troops were in Babylon at the time. They were the third largest contingent. But their ambassador said that if they took any casualties, they were going to pull all the Polish troops out. So I had to drive in circles around Babylon, around their perimeter, to make sure their perimeter wasn't hit. from the outside, producing a casualty. So the bizarre activity of Iraq and the coalition itself trying to figure out what to do and how to do it and who was in charge and who should be in charge is such a mess that it changed all the time. When I left in 2005, it became another country again. Before me, there hadn't been an election in Iraq. Before me, it was 2004, which was mostly noted for Fallujah. You just never knew exactly what Iraq was going to do, because I think its biggest problem was Iraq had no sense of itself. And in order to be a nation, that's the first thing you need to have. That's the only thing you can fight for, is if you have a clear sense of definition. The Kurds had that. And then the Islamic State came in. And they were invited in by the Sunnis, who realized that they couldn't win with a vote. And Maliki was cutting them off. This is a whole different period of what Iraq was. And they're still dealing with that now. So it's a hard question. You almost had to ask me a particular question about it and where. When I went back, I returned in 2013. I took a cab and an interpreter unarmed and went to the Iranian border from Baghdad. Not the best idea, by the way. But I went kind of in disguise. I bought glasses without prescriptions at Walmart. I bought street clothes in Baghdad. And I just took a camera and a small bag, and we went back to the towns that I had been the provisional military mayor of on the Iranian border, Jassan and near Badra. And I was hoping not to be noticed and recognized, which is a kind of a, you know, a strange thing. So they'd only seen me in a helmet, shaved, and I went there bushy. And I slouched instead of sitting upright in military attention. I did everything that I hadn't done as an infantry officer in 2003, and it had been 10 years, and I hadn't seen a single article on what that place was like. But to answer your question, I went back to that town, and it was perfectly fine. It was a Shia town. It was benefiting from Iranian trade. It had been the first town council that I was part of, you know, partially engineering and partially just overseeing what they were doing by themselves. They were ahead of us, actually, on that. As soon as the Baathists left, they kind of got their elders together and started to figure out how to run a town in the absence of a government, which helped us because we weren't that good at it. And they told me stories about me, which I thought was kind of amazing. There weren't many. I wasn't that memorable, all told, even though I was there for 5 months. So it was like hearing stories at your own funeral, you know, of you, and they aren't bad.
Right.
Like, nobody was angry. They just disappointed that we left and hadn't finished what we'd started and that we'd let the country fall to pieces. So, you know, I could tell you that if I went back to Ramadi right now, it's leveled. I've seen pictures from the drone. And all the things I built there, all the schools, all the clinics, everything that I'd hoped to improve that they would eventually take for granted enough to defend and preserve and sustain have been destroyed. Everyone who died there just died there. And that's a harder, you know, that's a harder question to ask me. What do I think about that? And for everyone who went, they were in different places. Some people never left the FOB. You know, they were part of the war, but not in the war. And they would have a very different perception of what Iraq was also. You know, it's been so many years now. And you also begin to become influenced by what's reported. You know, how much of your history do you even know? And that's why I like Soldier's Story by Hemingway in this book we read from Standing Down, because it's after the war that he reads about the war and finally learns about the war. Because, I mean, we all have this very small piece of it in our experience, no matter what level we're at. You know, I had a lot, access to a lot of information, but not all of it. I really only knew about my section of the world, and headquarters only knew about my section of the world by what I told them. You know, and that was that way everywhere. I'm disappointed. You know, how could I not be?
So let me segue into a somewhat lighter topic, somewhat, because while you were still on duty in Iraq, in between actually tours, as I understand it,
yeah,
was part of the time that you were acting on the wire.
Yeah.
And I'm just wondering, I mean, how do you know that you could make time to actually be on a critically acclaimed television show and know that, you know, when you're done with that, you're going to have to go back and continue your duty as a Marine?
I didn't know. I got out of the Marines after my first tour. I got out of the Marines three or four times before that. It's kind of like that, the Godfather. Just when I'm out, they pull me back in. And I did get continually pulled back in. I, my sense of responsibility.
So by your own choice?
My own choice, yeah. I was given involuntary orders, but I thought I could fix Ramadi. I thought I could save it from becoming Fallujah. That was our job. Because I learned so much on my first tour, I was the one. I just saw so many mistakes happening, which I thought were obviously mistakes, that maybe I could, you know, change that. Maybe I figured something out in my first tour. Between that and reading Seven Pillars of Wisdom by Lawrence of Arabia, I was somehow going to cure Iraq in one spot. And the biggest danger you have is feeling that you have something of value, becoming good at something to the point where you believe you're necessary. The military will move on without you always. It's a very large organism, but your blood vessel in it, somehow you feel it's a piece of brain tissue instead. And I thought that I could change the course of history in a small place and keep a few Marines alive in that city. So I went to that city specifically, which was the worst place there was, and found myself to be incapable, you know, of stopping that. So in between there, I went back to doing what I do. I was a filmmaker, and I auditioned for a show that was on HBO that I hadn't seen because I'd been in Iraq, that everyone said was great if they were smart, and everyone else hadn't watched at all. And I was cast for one line in one episode as just a police officer in the background. And it was interesting because I'd finally tried to grow my screaming monkey Marine cut out, let the hair come out on the sides. I'd grown some scruff in my face, all of which felt like a violation of some kind. And I auditioned with that, and I guess I looked bitter enough after that tour to have some certain energy that I was projecting for this cop. And I got to set, and the director said, you know, I think we want to make you look a little more edgy. I'm like, more edgy than this? And they shaved the sides back on the, you know, like the one cut. I couldn't get a job as an actor for all the years I'd been in the Marines, in the reserves or otherwise. And they restored the sides, but left the top longer and left the kind of a foo on the front. And I probably had the harshest haircut in television for a while. But yeah, the entire season shot out. And then I went back to Iraq for 2005. Came back just in time for the next season of The Wire to begin, and grew my...
And you were on it through the end of the series, almost.
Yeah, I was a minor supporting character as Cleecho, who kind of came in late. It wasn't time to develop yet another storyline, which they had so many already running for. But for someone who was supposed to have one line in one episode, you know, I ended up being an 18 because they kind of liked... I think they liked the fact that they didn't have that uncompromising cop, the one who sees everything in black and white while the rest of the show is obviously watching it in gray. And so I'm constantly furious with everybody. And it was kind of the perfect role to have after Iraq, because what could be more disappointing than that?
Was it also, in a way, I don't know, therapeutic to play someone who I just gather is quite different from who you are? I mean, you're sitting here talking to you. You do see the world in shades of gray. You see nuance. So to throw yourself into this role where you get to play this guy who says, hey, the law's the law. Okay, we got to follow orders, but man, we should be locking people up. I mean, was there something that was, you know, I don't know, almost visceral in being able to play that role?
Well, yeah, certainly. Also, because, you know, I had to disguise my frustration in Iraq. You know, as the officer meeting with all these villagers, the worst thing you can possibly do, and we did it everywhere in Iraq, was insult anyone by being upset with them. You know, it's disregarding their cultural predispositions. I mean, in Iraq, a lot of what you hear is a lie. And you have to ask questions around it to find the pieces of truth in it. Because it's, you know, it's a cultural thing. For many years, especially under the Ba'ath Party, why would you tell the truth? And why would they trust us? So I was always frustrated in meetings because I would only get a piece of what I needed to know to be able to help them. And of course, the way the war was being administered, when they disbanded the entire military in Iraq and just turned the entire country into a bunch of unemployed military trained 18-year-olds with AKs, I'm thinking, okay, this is bad policy. And we're going to have to deal with this on a blood level at some point. So a lot of things were happening that I was looking at as being, you know, disastrous, but I couldn't express it that way. I couldn't play the angry officer all the time because, of course, your unit's going to become sour. Your relationship to towns and people is going to sour. If they felt like I was there to rule, that's exactly what we didn't want to project. And so I came back from hiding all that to be a total bastard on the streets of Baltimore, where that guy exists in our culture. I mean, look at these elections. So the absolutist was allowed to run free and undisguised and unfiltered. And that was Colicchio. And my favorite roles are where I get to be anyone but me, where I get to truly hide in someone other than myself with a different background, something I really have to think my way into and act. I think the hardest role I ever had was in Generation Kill, which after I'd left my second tour, we went to shoot Generation Kill for HBO. It's a 7-part miniseries about the invasion of Iraq by 1st Marine Recon. And we shot it in Africa. The war was still going on, and I was dressed as a Marine again, playing a Marine officer.
So this should be the role that you're meant for,
it should
right?
have been the easiest thing in the world, but the entire time, it was hard to be natural because I felt it was acting. I felt being myself to be, you know, not genuine on a certain level, even though it's the most genuine thing I could do. So it was actually the thing I struggled the most with, was playing something that was just me. I liked stepping sideways a little bit and being able to, you know, inhabit someone who, you know, who has his own personality. So it was strange.
One last question for you I have to ask. As someone who grew up in New York, obviously ended up in Hollywood for a while, served in Iraq, for The Wire, you're on the streets of Baltimore. How do you end up in northern Michigan from all that?
Well, my wife is a Russian historian. She teaches at Ferris State. And if you're in the humanities, you know that you take the job that's available on the entire earth. And it was Ferris State University in Big Rapids. And so after my second tour and before Generation Kill, I flew from Michigan to audition for Generation Kill in Baltimore to go then film in Africa and fly back and forth to Michigan. But she took a job at Ferris State, where she's been for 10 years now. And I got to the state first. And after Iraq, I wanted a big piece of farmland, as anything I could find. And this is just before the big crash. So there wasn't much available. And we got a place in a town called Reed City, a few miles out of it on 7 Mile Road, 80-acre farm, which was a complete disaster, just a wreck. And being who I am, I'm a builder, a stonemason too, when I was younger, I kind of looked at it and said, you know, I can fix that. It's still a complete mess if you come to visit, but I've done some things to it, and that's where we stay. That's where I've been planting apple trees, and in our back lot, in the back 40, I've planted, kind of on my own quietly, 4,486 trees, and it's one for everyone we lost in Iraq. Now, it's obviously not including Iraqis. It's not including anybody else, but
U.S.
military.
Troops were killed.
Yeah, I looked at the list from the Department of Defense, and I plant a tree and say a name. And, you know, it's kind of I thought it was the best thing I could do, is replace a life with something alive, something that would live beyond me. I'll never see it as a forest, you know, and I think that's what the country needs to be thinking. You know, we need to be thinking for a future that's beyond us, not our immediacy. And so slowly, that entire vanished army of us will be growing in that backfield in the form of red and white oak and black cherry and sugar maples. And, you know, I think this is the first year I started seeing some of them break out of their 6-foot tubes. So that's what I do on our farm when I'm home. I like to work their land. I've always loved to dig. You know, in my book, I have that whole chapter on soil because I've always been a digger. So, yeah, that's what we do up there. And Tracy, you know, my wife, takes it to the college every day to try to teach it history that we might learn from it this time.
Benjamin Bush, thank you very much for your time.
It's been a pleasure. Thanks for having me again.
Benjamin Bush is a writer, actor, and a Marine veteran. He served 2 tours in Iraq, and he has been leading workshops called Talking Service at Western Michigan University this fall for veterans and their families. You can find more details through a link at WMUK.org. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans.